Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is an official podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Becca Barris, writer and copy editor for the Journal of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who work in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the field. These are people who represent the cutting edge in emergency dispatch, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today's topic is the reclassification of emergency dispatchers. Our guest wrote his master's thesis on the subject, discussing why the current classification is a problem and what steps need to be taken to fix it. Captain Kevin Haight has over 21 years of law enforcement experience with the Idaho State Police and, among many other roles, is currently appointed to the Idaho Public Safety Communications Commission. Welcome, Captain Haight.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. It's my honor and privilege. I look forward to the conversation.
So to get us started, could you give us a quick rundown of your career path? How did you get into law enforcement and how long have you been in the field?
Yeah, so I joined the Idaho State Police back in 1999. Obviously went through the academy and became a state trooper. I tell everybody I am still a state trooper. My rank is captain, but we're all state troopers. Other than being a dad, the second most important title for me in my lifetime was to be a state trooper, and I'm very proud of that and proud of the years of service that I have given to the state of Idaho. Those are over 21 years. In fact, I'm approaching 22 years of service, and my career has spanned a number of different things. I've spent many years in the patrol sector. For about 9 of those years, I was a crash and crime scene reconstructionist. And of course, over that time, have promoted up from sergeant to lieutenant. And now my current rank is captain. And I oversee our emergency dispatching program, among other things.
So how long have you been involved with emergency dispatch? How long have you been overseeing it?
So I moved into this position back in 2013. So I have been immersed in the emergency dispatching profession as a full-time part of my job duties since the summer of 2013. I initially transferred into this position as a lieutenant. About 3 years ago, that position was reclassified to a captain's position. Some more things were added to my plate. I now oversee our emergency dispatching system. And in addition to that, I'm responsible for all things radio related. So our radio system infrastructure, our technology systems, radio consoles, our 911 telephony system, all of that. And then as you mentioned in my intro, I am appointed by the governor. I sit on the state 911 board known as the Idaho Public Safety Communications Commission. And I chair one of its subcommittees, which is called the Idaho PSAP Standards and Training Committee.
So you've been involved with emergency dispatch for a while then, probably more than other people who are in law enforcement. How did you specifically get involved or interested in the question of reclassifying emergency dispatchers?
You know, Rebecca, that's a great question. As a police officer, I've always had an affinity for our dispatchers. I mean, they are our lifeline. They are our backup, if you will, until boots on the ground arrive. And they do an exceptional job with that. So I've always been proud to serve alongside my dispatchers, and I've always viewed them as a very integral part of delivery of public safety services. But after I moved to this position in 2013 and was on the 911 board and chairing the Idaho PSAP Standards and Training Committee, Idaho was a state that had no standards, no mandated standards for the emergency dispatcher, and the PSAP Standards and Training Committee was charged with trying to see that changed. And there had been an effort underway for a few years preceding my involvement to do that, and it kept going nowhere. In 2015, I attended a training at the Pocatello Police Department put on by the Denise Amber Lee Foundation. That class was titled A Victim's Plea, and it was that class where I met Nathan Lee for the first time, And that class completely changed my perspective. I went through an epiphany, if you will. For those of you that don't know, Denise Amber Lee was the young wife of Nathan Lee, mother of two little boys. And for me, even more interesting than that was she was the daughter of a sergeant with a sheriff's office. I'm a father of three girls. And the story hit me like a ton of bricks. Denise was kidnapped off the back porch of her South Florida home on January 17, 2008, brutally raped for several hours, and subsequently murdered. The murder was completed by the dastardly deeds of a male, but he was allowed to commit those deeds because of some abysmal failures of a 911 center in South Florida that received no less than five 911 calls, including one from Denise herself, surreptitiously using her captor's cell phone unbeknownst to him. That emergency communication center belonged to the sheriff's office that Denise's own father had worked for his entire career. So his peers in that dispatch center, they unfortunately were ill-prepared for the day. And ill-prepared, I mean they were undisciplined, unorganized, dysfunctional, ill-trained, and they failed in that pivotal moment, which allowed Michael King to complete his final deed and murder her. It was after learning that story and taking on the perspective not of Nathan Lee, the young husband, and I certainly sympathized and empathized with him, but I, as a police officer, looked at this through the lens of Sergeant Rick Goff, Denise's dad, a sergeant that worked for the very agency that failed him, failed Denise. And here I am in charge of emergency dispatching for my agency in Idaho and heavily involved in 911 decision-making processes in Idaho. And I sat there in that class and said, this cannot happen in Idaho. I cannot allow this to happen. And so that's where I've gotten my passion.
So you heard the story, you were moved by the story, and knew that you were in a position where you could make a change, where you could make the people around you listen and say, this is why reclassification is important. This is why call taking standards are important. This is why dispatch standards are important. You saw that opening and you took it. So the central question of the thesis is, how could the nation's 911 system, specifically its emergency communications officer occupation or ECO occupation, evolve to address problems and maximize advantages to public safety and homeland security? What does that mean to you? And how did you arrive at that question?
So first, just let me say real quick, my master's degree was completed at Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. It's a federal program through the Center for Homeland Defense and Security. And one of the benchmark requirements of that program is you have to produce a thesis that is homeland security, public safety related. And it needs to be on a research topic that has not already been written about, researched about ad nauseum. Apart from the passion that I have, it was also the program and the program requirements that led me to choose this topic. At the outset, and I say this at the very beginning of my thesis, I would like to first acknowledge that there are some emergency communications officers and emergency communication centers across this country, many, many, that are doing outstanding, exceptional work. They are adhering to the most robust, exceptional standards. And my research is by no means intended to cast aspersions on the discipline or on those centers at all. Rather, it is intended to shine a light from a macro perspective on our national 911 system. And when I say that, I'm talking about personnel, technology, and the policy slash political leadership around the system. And I come with a conclusion that there must be an intervention of the status quo. So while we have centers and dispatchers that are certainly meeting the high marks of standardization and professionalization, systemically, we have a long ways to go. And so I looked at it from a more macro perspective, and I just want to make sure everyone understands that. My research question implies, and I certainly do posit, that our nation's 911 system is a neglected system. I believe this because there is far too much anecdotal evidence to deny that premise. So I tried exploring some tangible ways that we could move professionalization and standardization initiatives further down the field, you will, within the 911 system, and as a result, bring about some needed enhancements, bring about that intervention of the status quo that I talk about. So that's what that question means to me, and that's kind of how I arrived at that question.
Right. So simply put, the system, the national system, needs changes. You're not looking to fix everything, right? Because it's huge. It's a huge system and there's lots of moving parts to it. But what you're looking to do is to shake things up.
Yes.
And to make things better for the nation, for the dispatchers, for the system itself. You're not going to fix it, but you're trying to, like you said, move the ball 10 or 20 yards down the field. So your thesis is broken into three aspects of the profession that needs to be addressed to be able to move the profession forward. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, I choose three, like you just alluded to. There are more. No argument from me. When you do a project like this, you have to scale it, though. And so I chose three things that I think are glaring issues within our national 911 system. And then I tried to address those. The first one was the Office of Management and Budget's classification of public safety telecommunicators currently under the Office and Administrative Support occupational classification. So our emergency dispatchers nationwide are classified by our federal government organization that classifies every occupational position that exists. They classify our emergency dispatchers as clerical workers. And no offense to secretaries, administrative assistants. My administrative assistant is an amazing person, an amazing professional, does amazing work. This isn't an offense on that occupation whatsoever, but our emergency dispatchers do not perform secretarial, clerical type of work. And so I try to attack that as one of the points. Back in 2017 and 2018, the national 911 industry, if you will, associations such as APCO, NENA, and others, with bipartisan and bicameral support, actually tried to move that classification from the clerical classification over to the protective service occupations category, which is where police, fire, EMS, amazingly, even crossing guards for schools and school bus monitors and security guards are in that classification. So there was an effort in 2017 to move dispatchers over to that occupational classification. And unfortunately, even with bipartisan, bicameral support and industry-wide support, the Office of Management and Budget ultimately refused to do it in 2018. And they argued this, and I'm going to read this verbatim because it's exactly the words they used. They said, quote, "The work performed is that of a dispatcher, not a first responder. Most dispatchers are precluded from administering actual care, talking someone through procedures, or providing advice. Moving the occupation to the protective services major group is not appropriate, and separating them from the other dispatchers would be confusing. Also, dispatchers are often located in a separate area from first responders and have a different supervisory chain," end quote. So if you break that paragraph down, there really is about six assertions made in there, and I try to dissect those and challenge those within my thesis. The second point of my three points or areas that I try to address in the thesis is the ongoing and systemic staffing and funding paucity issues that exist within our national 911 system. And again, tons of anecdotal evidence for that area as well. And then lastly, my third area that I shine a spotlight on is mandated professionalization and standardization initiatives. And when I talk about mandated, I'm talking about not agencies mandating it. I'm talking about states and U.S. territories mandating it. Just like myself as a police officer, I am required by state law to meet a hiring standard, a training standard, a continuing education standard. That's a professionalization of my discipline. And so I shine a spotlight on the need for that to be carried out with our first responders, our emergency dispatchers. Interestingly enough, while I'm on that point, I will just say it's shocking when you look at all 50 states and U.S. territories. I did extensive research on this, and out of like 50 states and then six U.S. territories, we have only 12 of those jurisdictions that have a mandated hiring standard for the emergency dispatcher. And when I say a hiring standard, I'm talking about a character standard. So you can't be a police officer if you've been convicted of any felonies. That's the same thing I'm talking about for dispatch. You can't be an emergency dispatcher if you've been convicted of felonies. You can't be a dispatcher if you've been convicted of even certain misdemeanors. Only 12 of our jurisdictions require a hiring or character standard. Only 29 require a basic training standard and certification. Out of those 29, only 23 of those require any kind of a continuing education standard. And lastly, only 24 of those jurisdictions require the use of medical dispatching protocols. So pretty shocking. In some of those categories, around half of our nation has standards. So a lot of work to be done. And I end this section with saying this. All of this exists. All three of these areas exist currently because the public safety telecommunicator is an undervalued, undertrained, and undercompensated discipline. And I lay a lot of blame for that at the feet of my profession.
There's a lot that you just went over, and there's a lot I want to touch on. So first thing is, I like that you tie together the three aspects of the profession, because standardization of the profession and standards in 911 dispatching, those aren't seen as important because the profession isn't seen as important, right? If people don't recognize that dispatchers, emergency communications officers, are doing more than just answering the phone and sending trucks every which way, right? They are giving pre-arrival instructions, post-dispatch instructions. And the money thing comes into it too. You said there's a paucity of funds, which just means there's no money for 911 centers, for the dispatchers, for the training. And so all of those things are interconnected. And if you shake up one of them, hopefully the other two will follow. And then the thing that you ended on, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but you said that a lot of the reason that dispatchers aren't recognized as doing as much as they do is at the feet of other law enforcement officers. Could you talk more about that?
Yes, I'm happy to. What I said was that the discipline is undervalued, undertrained, and undercompensated. And I lay a lot of blame for that, not all of it, but a lot of blame for that at the feet of my very discipline. And I'm not proud to say that. What I am proud to say is that I work for an agency that has actually held our emergency dispatch program in pretty high regard for my entire career, and I'm lucky to be able to say that and to lead this team with the kind of support I have from my agency. But looking at this again from a macro perspective, for example, back in 1998 in Florida, the very state where the Denise Amber Lee tragedy happened, in 1998, a chief of police tried to get the state of Florida to implement mandated hiring and training standards for emergency dispatchers, and his peers, his colleagues, shot it down categorically, saying it wasn't needed, saying that the reason it wasn't needed is every dispatch center uses different equipment. They use different CAD systems. They use different radio systems. They use different protocols. How can we have a basic minimum standard? And that's just one example of the apathy that I have seen among my discipline towards the emergency dispatching profession. And it's unconscionable, it's unexcusable, and I'm in a position to try to influence change, and I'm proud to be in that position. I want to use my position to influence that change. The argument that minimum standards aren't needed or aren't necessary because they dispatch centers use different protocols and different systems and different radio systems and et cetera, that's just nonsense, because we do in law enforcement. We don't all drive the same kind of patrol cars. We don't all shoot the same kind of guns. We don't all use the same kind of radio systems or law enforcement records management systems. But we are required to meet a basic hiring standard and training standard and continuing education standard. And so the argument is just lame and outdated and insincere, quite frankly. That's why I say what I do, that I lay a lot of blame for it at the feet of my profession. The other reason I say that is because in my research, according to NINA, there are roughly 5,748 emergency communication centers across the country. About 4,565 of those, or 79% of those, are owned and operated by sheriff, police, fire, state patrol, highway patrol, marshal, law enforcement, state trooper, ambulance, or EMS type organizations. So if there's a problem with the system, and 79% of the system is owned and operated by the very discipline I represent, law enforcement or fire and EMS, but I'm law enforcement. If there's a problem with the system and 79% of that system is owned and operated by my discipline, then who else do we blame for it? I've seen it myself. You know, we relegate our emergency dispatchers far too often to a subordinate role. We consider them just support staff. And boy, that is so short-sighted. I go through my thesis, I cite some examples where an emergency happens up in northern Idaho. A woman drives into the lake. Her car is sinking. The emergency dispatcher that took that call, immediately utilizing protocols, gave pre-arrival instructions. And just to make this very short, by the time the first responders arrived on scene, the emergency was over. Yeah, the woman's car was in the water. She's wet. She's sitting on the shore, but she's safe and sound. Well, if that isn't a first responder role that led that woman to a safe and sound situation at the end of her emergency before police, fire, EMS even arrived, if that isn't a first responder role, then I don't know a first responder.
Right. And it's not only the caller that is protected by the emergency dispatcher, as it were. It's the responders going to this scene. The information that the dispatcher gathers is to help the law enforcement officers, the firefighters, the EMS responders, to help them be safe, to let them know what kind of scene they're responding to. So yeah, like you said, it is short-sighted not to train and fund and appreciate this huge group of people.
Right.
So in your opinion, Kevin, what's the best way to make this change happen? Is it appealing to the OMB? Is it making some sort of nationwide legislation? Is it raising public awareness to demand reclassification or standardization?
I would say all of the above, Rebecca. An appeal to the OMB again. Legislation. By the way, there is legislation out there. It's called the 911 Saves Act. And it has bicameral and bipartisan support, but it has sat on the docket at our United States House of Representatives for whatever reason and hasn't got any kind of vote that's moved it on to the point that it could actually make it to the president's desk. And it's been sitting there for close to a year now. In fact, maybe just a little bit over a year. But that act, 911 Saves Act, specifically and explicitly would require the OMB to move the emergency dispatching profession to the public safety occupational classification. So legislation is a part of it. Appealing to the OMB is a part of it. Public awareness certainly helps. A couple other things that I do cite in my thesis, and I've used the term in this conversation today a few times, of public safety telecommunicator. I will tell you, I'm not a fan of that. I use it because that's what the industry has adopted. But in my thesis, I talk about that being an ambiguous term, and I personally do not believe that's helpful to the cause at all. If you ask Joe on the street what a telecommunicator is, I would submit to you, you would get all kinds of answers because it's ambiguous. And not only that, even if you did ask some Joe on the street and they said, oh, that's probably a 911 operator or, you know, whatever they might say, I still think it's an ambiguous term because our emergency dispatchers do not just telecommunicate. They are talking on the radio. They are talking on the phone, the telecommunicate part. But they are doing data mining for us, you know, researching subjects, finding criminal histories. There is so much more to what an emergency dispatcher does than just telecommunicate. So I think our industry, quite frankly, has done a disservice to the cause by adopting these ambiguous terms. And I would encourage the industry to move towards a much more noble and all-encompassing term. I really like what we use in state statute here in Idaho, which is the emergency communications officer. It elevates the title of the position, and it's not nearly as ambiguous. But whether we use that term or we use something else, I am not a fan of telecommunicator. So I think we need to cease using that term. And then the other big thing that I talked about earlier is the apathy that exists within the police, fire, EMS community about these issues as it relates to the 911 system and the emergency communications officer. It's the 21st century. It's time that we put down our old, outdated ideas about this profession. And it's time we recognize that these people are arm in arm, side by side with us in the provisioning of public safety to the citizens we serve. They are not relegated to a lesser role. It's an equal role. And they need to be treated that way. They need to be paid that way. They need to be advocated for in a sense that recognizes how responsible and how urgent and critical those positions are.
Right. And going back to what you said about the term telecommunicator being ambiguous or emergency dispatcher and narrowing it down to become emergency communications officer, one of the reasons that the OMB was against reclassifying dispatchers was because they said it would be too confusing to separate them out from truck dispatchers or taxi dispatchers or whatever.
Yes.
But, you know, if we change the name, that confusion wouldn't exist anymore and it would allegedly be easier to reclassify.
You're exactly right. That's part of the reason that I encourage abandoning that ambiguous term and going to something that's much more concise and, frankly, elevating and more realistic to what they do. I mean, emergency communications, whether it's administering life-saving pre-arrival CPR instructions or delivering a baby or instructing someone how to get out of a burning building or what have you. I mean, that's emergency communications.
Exactly. So just a couple more questions before we wrap up here. From the sound of it, anecdotal evidence, or, you know, stories, people's personal experiences were a big part of your research process. What other methods did you use to research your thesis?
So I used primary and open source published documents for everything I did, anecdotal evidence, all of that. It also would be considered a policy analysis. I looked at policies that exist state by state in terms of mandated standards. I looked at policies within the OMB and what their criteria is for a job classification. So I would say I used a lot of anecdotal evidence, but it was a policy analysis project, and that analysis came from primary and open source published documents.
Thank you for clarifying that. And then the final question is one I like to ask all of our podcast guests. What is the biggest takeaway that dispatchers should get from this episode?
I have two, and one is just going to be a teaser comment, and then I will close with my more primary comment to your question. The first one, the teaser, is Finland, and I would encourage your listeners, just Google and research what Finland has done with their emergency dispatching system in that country. If you want to look up my thesis as well, and you can Google that, it's easy to find 911: what's our emergency ? Diagnosing a struggling occupation serving a neglected system. You Google that, you'll find my thesis, and you can also read my research about Finland. But if every state and territory would model, at least to some degree, what Finland has done, man, we would be a long ways ahead of where we're at right now. Lastly, one of the biggest takeaways, apart from Finland, is that the Office of Management and Budget fails to follow its own standards when it comes to this classification and grouping issue. I took a look at air traffic control. For example, emergency communication centers are the nerve centers of public safety, not that dissimilar to what an air traffic control is to the transportation industry. I have often joked about or said just kind of tongue in cheek that our emergency dispatchers are the air traffic controllers of public safety. And if you think about it, they really are. There are eyes and ears out there. Interestingly enough, the Office of Management and Budget places the air traffic control occupation within the transportation and material moving occupations group, which is right among airline pilots, flight engineers, train conductors, baggage handlers, truck drivers, and numerous other transportation and material moving type occupations, okay?
Mm.
They aren't applying the same standard because if you remember early on in their rebuttal for why not to change the classification, they said that dispatchers are often located in a separate area from first responders and have a different supervisory chain. Well, air traffic controllers are not in trains. They're not in airplanes. They're not in airports. They're not in trucks. They are in a very separate area and answer to a very different chain of command, the federal government, from all of those other disciplines, and yet OMB puts them in that transportation and material moving occupations group. Clearly, the emergency communications officer works equally close, if not more closely, to the occupations that are within the protective service occupations group, such as police, fire, and EMS. And yet the OMB refuses to move them and makes the argument that they should stay right where they're at. The other point that you picked up on yourself is they argue that moving them would be confusing because there's other dispatchers. Well, that's assuming that the trucking company dispatcher or the tow truck dispatcher or the train dispatcher is the same type of work as an emergency dispatcher. And if you make that assumption, you are just ignorant of the facts. I think that's probably the big takeaway, is that the same standard that OMB is applying for some occupations is not the same standard that they're applying for the emergency dispatching occupation, unfortunately.
That's so interesting. I hadn't realized that that was the case. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and talking about this super important issue. And thank you so much for all that you're doing for this profession.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you for what you're doing. It's efforts such as you and your organization, and I'm happy to be a small part of these efforts too, but it takes a village, right? I think I'm stealing a phrase there, but it does. And so I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate this opportunity to shine a light on this, and I look forward to hopefully seeing things change.
Well, you and me both. As always, there will be relevant links and information in the show notes of this episode. And if you have any ideas for topics or if you have any questions, go ahead and email us at dispatchindepth@emergencydispatch.org. And once again, Kevin, thank you so much. And we will talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch in Depth. Remember, it really helps if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch in Depth is hosted by me, Becca Barris. I'm also the technical director and producer, and Matthew Maiko is the executive producer.